Welcome to the Sufi Reverberations podcast, where each week, God willing, you will be able to hear a poem, a story, a meditation, and a musical interlude that give expression to one Sufi's perspective concerning the mystical dimension of Islam. My name is Anab Whitehouse, and I will be your host. Although I am not a sheikh, nonetheless, I did have the opportunity to spend 16 years in the company of a Sufi saint of the 20th century, and by the grace of God, was able to gain a few insights into the nature of the Sufi mystical path through that association. So, without further delay, let's proceed to the essential contents of this episode. Today's floratory selection is entitled, The Crowd Roared. The crowd roared and my ego bowed its head outwardly ever so slightly, in false humility as within it smiled a Cheshire smirk of vanity, while showing degrees of appropriately nuanced modesty without. Oh, how cunningly that creature moves about in its seedy suits of ignorance and arrogance, seemingly oblivious to everything but itself as it journeys through the peaks and valleys of time's ecology. What has my ego really achieved except wrongfully to take credit for the acts of the one through whom creation comes in measured drops of a rizq that mysteriously flows into our lives and then disappears into the cloud of unknowing which envelops our being from birth to death and perhaps beyond? Memories of my recently deceased cat, Callie, float in the mist of my mind. She is calling out to me in a kindly act of camaraderie, helping maintain clarity of focus with respect to that which is coming my way on its own inimical and fixed schedule. Yes, little one, I remember looking in your eyes as something receded from your body, like an ocean wave that had run its course, coming to nothing as the spark of life was extinguished from your vision. Yes, my friend, the heart knows that something partially final is on the horizon, even as ego goes blithely about its forays into this or that cul-de-sac. Like fiendish narcotics of the soul, the ego drug flows through my veins in an addictive rush of forgetfulness, and I nod off in the embrace of dreamy scenes spun from coquettish charms of delusional thinking. Soon there will be no time for fantasy when reality rises like an infinite sun, and one will realize how things might have been done so differently in the passion play called life and its missed opportunities. This edition of the short story goes under the heading of Second Opinion. A young man who lived in a rural area of a certain country had long dreamed of finding a spiritual guide. The evenings of his youth had been filled with stories told by his parents and some of their friends concerning different friends of God whom they all had met, either individually or collectively, together with accounts of some of the experiences which had transpired during those encounters. One spiritual guide in particular, who had been mentioned by both his parents as well as many of their friends, had an inexplicable attraction for the young boy. The lad kept pestering his parents to tell the same stories over and over again in relation to the boy's favorite mystical guide. As the youngster grew older, he searched out every piece of information he could uncover with respect to the same spiritual teacher. He visited the bookstores, the libraries, and various spiritual centers in the town in search of the sought-after material. Although he liked to read the works of various spiritual teachers,
No other guide held his interest nor fascinated the youth in the way this one friend of God did. The boy wanted more than anything to be able to go and visit the man and take mystical initiation with him, and until he could do this, he felt very restless, always longing for a distant source of his preoccupation. One book which the boy came across in the town library had an old photo of the saint. Immediately, the boy fell in love with the image in the picture. In fact, the boy was so infatuated that he ran up huge overdue fines because he couldn't bear to have the book with the prize picture leave his house. Eventually, the parents realized it would be cheaper to special order the book at the local store than to have to go on paying the fines on the boy's behalf. When the boy was in his late teens, an opportunity presented itself which enabled the youngster to visit the city where the saint resided. Fearing the spiritual teacher might be traveling somewhere else at the time of the boy's trip, the youth had written a letter to the spiritual center with which the guide was affiliated, seeking an audience with the teacher. The teenager was on pins and needles until a letter arrived from the distant spiritual center. The boy ripped open the envelope, read the contents, and whooped with joy because his request had been granted. Somehow, the youngster managed to survive the impatience he felt throughout the several months leading up to his trip. Eventually, that day came, as all days eventually do, and the teenager left for the destination, namely, the longed-for spiritual guide. When the boy arrived at the spiritual center, he presented the letter he had received several months previously and asked where he should go for his meeting with the teacher. The youngster was taken to a second-floor room and found the guide waiting for him. The two chatted about the boy's trip and life in the town where the teenager lived. The youngster mentioned his parents' names and described them a little, and the spiritual teacher indicated that he remembered both his mother and father. He laughed about some of the amusing events which the boy's parents had recounted to the youngster over the years. Nervously, the teenager edged closer to the issue which had been burning in his heart for such a long time. Finally, he blurted out, "I would like to be initiated by you. I want this more than anything. Not just the initiation per se, but initiation with you." And the youngster emphasized the word "you." "I don't understand what this is all about or why these feelings are within me, but you captivated my heart when I was just a boy, or at least more of one than I still am. And I have gone to bed every night since then with this question on my lips," said the youth. He looked imploringly at the teacher. A trace of concern spread across the face of the guide, and as the teacher's expression grew more concerned, the boy's spirits began to plummet. Surely, the youth's dream was about to be dashed. The friend of God saw the boy's condition change and quickly said, "There is no need for you to become alarmed. My concern is not over whether you should be accepted onto the path, but whether you will be doing so with what the lawyers refer to as informed consent." Although the boy's heart stopped its steep decline to despair, when he heard the words of the guide, the teenager was mystified. "I'm sorry," the boy said. "I don't understand. I have read a great many books on the subject and have talked with many, many people about the nature of the mystical path. While I realize I don't have any real experiential understanding of the nature of spirituality, I do feel that I understand enough to know this is what I want to do, especially with you." The guide smiled at the youngster's enthusiasm and fervor. He replied to the youth's words with, "I don't doubt you have read a lot, and I don't doubt the sincerity of your intention concerning initiation. But nonetheless, let's do this the right way, so there will be no doubt in your mind about what you are going to do." The teenager waited to hear the guide's proposal. The youngster couldn't imagine what would be requested of him, but the youth was ready to do whatever was necessary. The guide said, There is a yellow house about a mile to the east on the road which runs in front of the spiritual center. The house is on the same side of the street and near a variety store called Neighbors, and it is the only yellow house in that area. I want you to go to the house, ask to speak with a Dr. Smith, and without letting on that you have met me, tell the good doctor your story about wanting to become initiated through me. Before you begin your story, tell the doctor that someone who wishes to remain anonymous has sent you to the house to ask him his opinion of your idea and to seek his assistance in the matter. You shall listen to what he says without comment, but do feel free to ask whatever questions you like. When you are satisfied you have received all the information the doctor has about this matter, then come back here to the center and we will talk further. The teenager followed the instructions. About 40 minutes later, he was at the door of the yellow house. The youth knocked on the door, and a short while later, an elderly man with a friendly face appeared. The visitor explained his mission, and the man indicated that he, in fact, was Dr. Smith, and that the latter would consider it his sacred duty to speak with the youngster concerning the spiritual matter which had brought the boy to the doctor's door. The youth was taken into the living room and was guided to a spot near the far end of a couch that ran along one wall, nearly covering the length of the room. The doctor headed for a lounge chair, which was positioned near where the youngster had been taken. When the two were settled, the doctor became very serious and intense. He proceeded to berate the spiritual guide, who had, unknown to the doctor, sent the youth for the doctor's assistance and advice. The doctor had absolutely nothing good to say about the teacher. He called the guide a fraud, a charlatan, a con artist, an egotist, a lunatic, a dangerous influence, and someone who misleads people away from the truth of things and straight into damnation. The doctor had a wealth of information to share with the youngster and proceeded to do so. From time to time, the teenager asked the doctor whatever questions came to mind. When the doctor finally ran out of things to say, he concluded with, "Son, my advice to you is to stay as far away from that so-called mystical teacher as you can. He will cause you nothing but problems and try to trick you into wasting your life chasing after occult pipe dreams." The youth thanked the doctor for his time as well as the extensive information, and he indicated to the doctor that the conversation had given the youngster a lot about which to think. As the boy rose from the couch, the doctor rose with him, placed an arm of friendship around the teenager's shoulder, and walked the boy to the door where the two said goodbye. A short while later, the youth had returned to the center. Upon arriving, he sought out the guide once again. When the two were together, the teacher said, "Well, what happened?" The boy gave a blow-by-blow account, to which the guide listened attentively. When the youngster was through, the teacher said, "Well, in light of what you have been told, do you still want to be initiated by me?" The teenager nodded his head and said, "Yes, very much." "What the doctor said didn't alter your spiritual intention in any way?" inquired the teacher. The youngster shook his head, "No." Then the teenager asked, "Who is that man, and why did you send me to him?" The guide smiled and replied, "The good doctor is my uncle, and I thought you should have a second opinion before deciding what you want to do about me in the mystical path. Sometimes in the matter at hand, as with great many other issues, second opinions are very important, and of course sometimes they are not, and it was your responsibility to decide which was the case in the present set of circumstances. This is, to whatever extent it is possible, in human affairs, informed consent." This week's musical interlude is Between the Lines. Thank you.
From one tiny desk on a relatively small planet in a solar system that forms a speck, in a galaxy that exists along with billions of other galaxies amidst spatial voids, tens of millions of light years across on a material plane, that constitutes but one of many realms in God's indefinitely large universe. You are listening to the Sufi Reverberations Podcast.
The following meditative essay is called Faith.
From the perspective of Sufi masters, faith means something very different from what many people understand by that word. For practitioners of the Sufi path, faith is alive, dynamic, growing, rich, transformative, subtle, deep, wise, aware, and penetrating. If, however, one were to ask people to characterize the notion of faith, many of these individuals probably would come up with something along the following lines. Faith is a strong belief or opinion about the correctness of something. Such people, or at least some of them, might characterize faith as blind, dogmatic, antiquated, closed, infantile, static, primitive, and irrational. For many people, issues of faith conjure up images of superstition, myths, and magical thinking. As such, faith becomes something one resorts to when certain things happen in one's life, much as someone might knock on wood or throw salt over one's shoulder under certain circumstances. Other individuals consider faith to be something which, like myths, may bring meaning, order, and purpose to a person's life, but has little to do with reality. Such people also might contend faith is like the magical thinking which takes place at certain stages of childhood. In magical thinking, there is a sense one merely has to imagine something in order for this act of imagination to induce reality to conform to the character of what has been imagined. Many people consider faith to be, for the most part, relatively harmless, perhaps even beneficial. Faith is something that gets one through the day. Different people rely on various things to see them through the difficulties of day-to-day life. For some people, faith is the boat in which one rides out the inclement weather and storms of life. On the other hand, faith also has the capacity to be a very dangerous commodity in the wrong hands. Millions of people have been impaled on the faith of the true believers across history. Issues of faith have torn apart families, communities, and countries. In point of fact, faith of one kind or another plays a central role in the lives of almost everyone. This faith may not be spiritual in nature, but it is a species of faith. Faith is a relationship between, on the one hand, what is known or understood in the present, and on the other hand, how what is known now will carry into and unfold within the unknown future. Faith is the projective map which links our past experience to the future and links the known to the unknown. Faith is the way we orient ourselves in the present on the basis of past experience in order to be able to engage whatever transpires in the future with a sense of commitment and purpose. Even in a mundane, non-spiritual context, faith is more than just a belief. There is an intensity of conviction in faith which is not necessarily present in belief. In the case of faith, of whatever species, there is a readiness to act on the basis of that in which one has faith. On the other hand, one may have many beliefs on which one is not prepared to act. On the basis of past experience, one may have faith in one's family or one's country. One is convinced one can rely on them in a variety of ways. One is sure they will respond in the future as they have responded in the past. Consequently, one goes about one's present life with an orientation rooted in one's understanding of these aspects of past experience. One is prepared to engage the future on the basis of this understanding. Sometimes our family or country breaks faith with us. A spouse engages in adultery. A child gets into trouble with the law.
A country engages in certain brutal domestic or foreign policies, which one never thought would have been possible. One's faith has been undermined. One no longer knows how to look to the future. One no longer knows how to orient oneself in order to prepare for engaging life as it plunges into the unknown. On the basis of past experience, one has developed relationships of faith with many dimensions in one's day-to-day life. Indeed, one's whole life is shaped, colored, and directed by a system of faith relationships. Neighbors, friends, acquaintances, doctors, business associates, teachers, community leaders, scientists, newspaper columnists, television personalities, athletes, store employees, and so on, all interact to form a complex web of faith relationships in our lives. We establish a range of strong and weak faith links to different parts of our world. There is much we do not know about even those with whom we interact on a consistent and intimate or close basis. There is even more we do not know about many of the other people who touch our lives in one way or another. Nonetheless, on the basis of whatever direct and indirect experience we have, we trust some people and we do not trust others. We have faith in some people and we do not have faith in others. Whether our judgments about people are correct or accurate is not at issue here. As a result of whatever evaluation of or critical reflection of our experience with others that takes place, we spin our threads of faith which attach us, however strongly or tenuously, to those around us. Those threads will be broken or reinforced or will barely be attached depending on what happens in the future. The winds of change will affect the web of faith one has spun. A neighbor is indicted for embezzlement. A teacher is accused of sexual improprieties with a student. An unsavory person saves someone's life. A leader resigns under a cloud of scandal. A manager decides to deal more humanely with employees. A friend is fired for incompetence or dereliction of duty. One's spouse wants to give the marriage a more committed effort. A religious leader checks into a substance abuse facility. An enemy asks for one's forgiveness. An athlete is accused of shaving points. An acquaintance one hardly knows shows incredible kindness in a time of need. A scientist fudges data in a series of experiments. We shape our lives on the basis of the opinions, beliefs, conclusions, assessments, and judgments we make concerning the events of our day. We vote for people, avoid people, gossip about people, abuse people, condemn people, make friends with people, marry people, divorce people, value people, and marginalize people, all on the basis of the character of the faith, which is generated by our reflections on impressions derived from our experience, direct or indirect, with others. Even the lives of scientists and physicians are shaped by many elements of faith. A doctor, for example, has faith in her or his or their abilities, as say a surgeon, despite the fact that there may have been questionable judgment calls or mistakes in the past. A scientist has faith in the work of other scientists and relies on the work to inform and frame his or her own research. A scientist does not have time to replicate every experiment performed. They have faith other researchers are reporting on their work in a forthright, honest manner. Yet there have been more than a few scandals, both historically as well as in the present, in which scientists, both famous and unknown, knowingly have put forth spurious research material. A scientist has faith in the equipment used to make measurements or to detect the occurrence of certain phenomena. However, the scientist may have only limited knowledge of how the equipment actually produces its results. Instead, they may be relying on what technicians or company representatives or other scientists are telling them about the reliability of such equipment. A scientist or medical practitioner may have faith in the methodology of science and research because of the many valuable results which are produced by following that method. However, just as using the method has led to many blind alleys in the past, there is no guarantee one will obtain important results in the future. Not every scientist wins a Nobel Prize or makes important contributions. A lot of research is neither here nor there as far as value is concerned. Moreover, there are many areas such as morality, mysticism, religion, and creativity which seem to be totally impervious to the quantitative techniques and methods of science. In addition, many non-linear phenomena can only be roughly approximated, if at all, by scientific methods, yet most of life involves non-linear systems. Nevertheless, one goes with that in which one has faith. As long as the quantity and quality of positive experiences exceeds the quantity and quality of negative experiences, one will tend to keep faith with various judgments one has made on the basis of experience. Throughout the foregoing, there have been persistent themes of experience, change, growth, learning, judgment, reflection, critical assessment, and dynamics juxtaposed to the issue of faith. Faith, even in a mundane sense, has been shown to have potential for subtlety, complexity, nuances, and richness. Faith is something which is very much alive for most of us and central to the way we engage life. Sufi masters maintain that faith in a mystical context is quite consonant in its own manner with all of the foregoing. Spirituality is rooted in and permeated by experience and understanding of that experience. We have a relationship with God. God is interacting with us all the time through a variety of experiential channels, both within us as well as outside of us. We have dreams or mystical experiences or enter into certain spiritual conditions and states. We have interaction with our spiritual guide. We read sacred texts or we learn about the lives of great mystics of the past. We talk to other people both within and outside of the path. We try various kinds of practices and see what effects or results ensue. We attempt to live in accordance with the spiritual teachings of the path and take note of the problems and benefits which may arise. We reflect on the experience of other people whom we know and whom we have come to trust. Our life is like a scattered diagram of experiences. Consequently, we try to generate the hermeneutical equivalent to a regression line in statistics. We attempt to plot a lifeline which comes closest to representing the central trends of our scattered experiences. This regression line is our link of faith with our experiences. The slope of the regression line is a ratio of what has been experienced to our assessment of that experience. We extrapolate and interpolate with respect to the future on the basis of that regression line slope. As new experiences and assessments are added, we stay with or plot a new regression line. According to Sufi masters, the more one experiences the states, stations, tastes, expansions, contractions, and so on of the path, the deeper, richer, and stronger will one's faith become. There is nothing blind, dogmatic, closed, irrational, or static about this process. One learns, grows, develops, changes, and matures on the path. The structural character of one's faith undergoes growth, maturation, development, and so on. This transformation of faith is a function of one's own direct experiences and the teacher's guidance in helping one to come to an understanding of the significance, value, and meaning of such experience. As is the case with all mundane species of everyday faith, so too mystical faith weds together knowns and unknowns. On the basis of what is known or understood, one develops a commitment to certain dimensions of what is unknown and unseen. As faith develops, the horizons of the unknown may be pushed back to varying degrees. However, the horizon symbolizes the inexhaustible nature of existence in our relationship with God. No matter how much we advance towards the horizon always recedes into the distance. God willing, we increase in spiritual understanding, insight, wisdom, and knowledge but there will always be unknowns which modulate our interactions with divinity. Nonetheless, we continue to use what we know as the basis of our orientation towards what is unknown. When we have faith in God, we rely on God to be our trustee in all affairs. As we acquire enhanced degrees of faith, our faith is transformed, God willing, into a certitude that God will never abuse our faith or trust. This certitude is based on reflective experience and not on blind, unthinking, dogmatic belief and opinion. Unfortunately, a lot of people confuse being convinced of something with being certain in the mystical sense. Mystical certitude is a function of direct demonstration and experiential evidence of a sort that brooks no doubt as to its authenticity and truth. The experiences are overwhelming and incontrovertible in nature, and more importantly, they are corroborated in independent ways by other people and other experiences. To be convinced of something, however, merely means one has a strong opinion. Furthermore, this strong opinion is often held in the absence of any direct experiential demonstration. In addition, such an opinion of conviction often is rooted in an interpretation of experiences which leaves room open for considerable doubt. An individual might acknowledge the legitimacy of such doubt under these circumstances if the person meditated on the matter very much or with any degree of rigor, care, and consideration. However, all too frequently, people of strong convictions, whether spiritual or non-spiritual in character, are uninterested in entertaining any doubts concerning their firmly entrenched beliefs. On the other hand, with practitioners of the Sufi path, the examination and exploration of doubt can lead to some very beneficial insights and understandings. One is encouraged to work with doubt, not to deny and repress it. You have been listening to the Sufi Reverberations podcast. I hope you will join me next week for a new episode of this program. May peace be your companion.